Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind listener mail. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And hey, you've written into us. Now we're going to share back with you. Are you ready to get started, Rob?
Let's jump in.
Oh, what is this you've got right here at the top?
Oh, well, I threw some stuff in here. So a lot of the stuff we hear from our listeners comes in via our email. I guess that's still the primary way we communicate. But we do have a Discord channel. Which
is kind of
hard to get to. I think you have had to have been in the Facebook group for Stuff to Blow Your Mind, and that's where the invite for the Discord is. I don't know. I barely understand how Discord works, but I had a couple.
I don't think I was even aware of this.
Really? Oh, I thought you were aware. Well, anyway, there is a Stuff to Blow Your Mind Discord channel. I wish I could tell you how you can access it. Maybe you should tell me. If you want access to it, write in to our email address, and I'll send you the link or whatever. But I heard from a couple of our listeners there about our episode on the Whispering Sword, about sentient weapons in mythology and legend. And of course, we primarily looked at a few different mythological and folkloric examples, and we alluded to some fictional examples, but we didn't really spend a lot of time there. And we said, hey, let us know about some of your favorite fictional sentient weapons. And so I have a couple of good responses here.
Okay.
So Matt on Discord shares the following, quote, love the cold open on Whispers of the Speaking Sword episode, and honestly, the narrative readings and skits are always a highlight. Joe's comment on swords being entitled to the tribute of cleaning to keep them happy, and that cleaning a sword is also important for maintaining it, makes me wonder if Irish myth is where the concept of the Mechanicus belief, he's referring to something in Warhammer 40,000, in machine spirits and the need to placate them was drawn from. In the Warhammer 40,000 universe, upkeep of technology has become ritualized to the point that a firearm spirit must be placated by anointing it with sacred oils, lest it fail in combat, with no consideration given to the physical impact that the oil has on the weapon's operation. The ritual of anointing the weapon has the desired effect, just not for the reasons they think.
You know, it's funny. I can imagine things happening in the real world in a fashion like this, though not understanding the real reason you're performing maintenance on something and turning it into a like a religious ritual would certainly make the practice less adaptable. Like you wouldn't, you know, understand as well, like how you need to change the practice to respond to changes in conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think he may be onto something here because there's a lot in that universe about, you know, forgotten technology that can no longer be replicated, but can only be maintained and is maybe only half understood at best.
Yeah.
Fletch on Discord shares the following. That was a great episode, but no mention of Stormbringer. Elric of Milnibone's bloodthirsty demonic blade. This is, of course, referencing the books by Michael Moorcock, which I think I've actually read one of them and I enjoyed it. And then Michael Moorcock also wrote the lyrics to Veteran of the Psychic Wars by Blue Oyster Cult, among his many other accomplishments.
I know you've had that on your mind lately.
Yeah, it's a solid jam. Fletch continues, also from the Odyssey, quote, the blade itself incites to deeds of violence, was used as the title of Joe Abercrombie's first excellent fantasy novel, or an even better translation of the same phrase, for iron by itself can draw a man to use it, seems super relevant when Robert and Joe were talking about how tools can encourage you to see every problem in terms of their use.
Oh, yeah, of course. And you can realize this in a million different ways. I mean, I think, for example, if I'm remembering this right, I think Immanuel Kant wrote about the idea that a country that has a standing army will always be tempted to find uses for the army in the same way that a person who's holding a weapon will be more tempted to think of ways that a weapon should be used in a scenario where, you know, if they didn't have the weapon on their person, they might not think that it was so important to choose violence.
Now, speaking of British sci-fi and warfare science fiction, Fletch also shares, another one just sprang to mind. I'm not sure if it's a bit obscure, but Rogue Trooper, the genetically engineered super soldier from the 2000 AD comic strip, had a rifle, helmet, and backpack that had the personality chips of three of his dead comrades, Gunner, Helm, and Bagman, or Bagman, that would talk to him and could operate equipment by themselves.
Interesting. Okay. I'm not familiar with this comic.
I'm familiar with it, but I've never read it. When it comes to 2000 AD, I've read a lot of Judge Dredd, and I don't think I've read any Rogue Trooper.
Oh, that's – okay. Judge Dredd is 2000 AD.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
cool.
But there are several – like he's probably the most well-known. Yeah, he's definitely the most well-known 2000 AD character in world, but there are various other settings and worlds that are popular underneath that umbrella as well.
I hear he is the law.
Yes, he is.
All right. So we've been getting tons of emails in response to queuing. This has got to be one of our highest mailbag ratio episodes of all time.
Oh, definitely.
We've gotten the same way that probably still the most we ever got, I would guess, was the one about school dreams.
Yes. Those still trickle in.
Yeah. Yeah. Those all the time. We got so many of those. We couldn't even scratch the surface. But we've also got a lot about queuing. So we'll try to catch up reading some of these. Sorry if you were one of the many emailers on queuing. Sorry, we can't even come close to reading all of these. But I grabbed a few here, and I guess we'll dip in. So this first message comes to us from Max. Max says, hi, Robert, Joe, Seth, and Carney. Longtime listener here from Sydney, Australia. I was talking about your episodes on queuing with my partner who lives in Singapore and has always said Singaporeans love to queue. And she reminded me of a cultural queuing experience that took me by surprise. A few years ago, whilst in Singapore, she brought me to a reputable Michelin star restaurant to eat chicken rice. Waiting for food was handled in an orderly manner by means of a ticketed queuing system. However, finding a table in the dedicated dining area required self-governance. This manifested as unseated patrons analyzing people who were already seated to determine who would finish eating the fastest, e.g., do they have a child, are they talking a lot, how full are their plates, etc. A sweet spot in the room could then be selected for standing and waiting in until a nearby customer finished their meal and yielded their table. I must emphasize the nearby in this statement, as there were many other people doing the same thing in different areas. My partner assured me that this was common practice, yet I still felt uncomfortable with both waiting purposefully in order to encourage people to eat faster, and then later with the experience of others waiting for us. Queues for food court seating in general are a little bit lawless at the best of times. However, this was not a public food court. Thanks for your episodes over the years and also for recommendations such as Blindsight and the Rifters series. Looking forward to that future Star Trek episode, Max.
Yeah, we do need to do something Star Trek related eventually. I was just thinking about that the other day.
This is really interesting because, of course, you're talking about like pairing the different kinds of waiting experiences, one that is like just opportunistic and self-governed and the other that's an orderly first come, first serve queue. And it's funny that the first come, first serve queue is the first half of the experience, but then you have to find a place to sit. I've been to places. In fact, there's even like a food court type place here in Atlanta that I've been several times that it is much like this. You know, you wait in line to get your food, but then you've got to find a table. And that's actually the really stressful part.
That point you got your food like on a tray in many cases. And then where are you going to go? Like, that's the worst. It's like, oh man, am I going to have to like squat and gobble this meal somewhere?
Yeah, totally. And then the other interesting thing about it was how it changes your mentality about queuing and ordering access when what you're trying to get access to is not like a good or service that you get done and then you can leave, but an experience. Like if you're sitting down to have a meal, is you're paying to have a nice experience that is going to be pleasant. And obviously if that experience is tempered by the fact that you're aware people are like looming over your shoulder, hurrying you to get up, that does seem like that. I don't know. But it sounds like, for people who are used to it, and this is a common way of ordering restaurants, if you're used to it, I guess it just doesn't bother you.
I guess it's like, and this, I'm very much talking pre-pandemic times here, it's like if you travel to somewhere like New York City and you realize, oh, if I go to eat at a restaurant, I'm going to be exceedingly close to everybody else in that restaurant because that's just how dining spaces tend to work in a city like this. Yeah. Like that can be shocking. If you're coming from a place where you tend to have more of a spacious dining experience, but if you've experienced it enough, if you've been in New York City long enough, then you would grow accustomed to that sort of environment, and it just makes sense that you're this close to other people.
Yeah. Rob, I wondered if you might want to read this one from Matt, because I wonder if you've had a similar experience to what Matt describes here with air travel.
Okay. Matt writes, "Hello, Robert and Joe. I love the show and really enjoy the deep ways you think about topics. I have three thoughts about waiting in line. Firstly, at the airport gate, when they call my section to board a plane, 100 or so people jump to their feet to make a long line, while I prefer to stay in my seat as long as possible. Being 6'2 tall, I don't see the point of rushing to leave my chair with plenty of leg room to squeeze into the tiny and cramped coach seat on the plane, let alone stand in line, a line that doesn't help me in any way to gain a better position on the plane. Secondly, I would like to point out the disappointing feeling that occurs when you join a line and nobody else joins the line for a long time or never. It makes the time spent in the line feel like so much more of a waste when I could have done something else productive for all that time and not missed out on my place in line. And lastly, when I was in elementary school in Australia in the 1980s, kids would frequently ask for baggage, being asked, 'Can I have baggage?' And it meant, 'May I get in line behind you?' The person would usually grant the baggage if they liked you, and hence you'd only ask for baggage from a friend, because it was an unofficial law amongst the kids. Although the kids trailing in line were unhappy about it, they would never complain about the injustice. Thanks for all the learning I get, Matt."
Rob, I could be mistaken, but I feel like what Matt describes about the airport experience sounds like a rant you've given me before. Am I wrong about that?
I don't know. Possibly. I mean, airports make people rant, and I'm no exception to that rule. I would say the only exception that I have to Matt's statement here is that, yes, of all things were equal, I would prefer not to wait in line to then go get on a plane and be cramped in a seat. However, more often than not, part of wanting to get on the plane first is not so much about getting your seat, which is generally on most flights anyway. I mean, I think there's some airlines where it is kind of first come, first serve. But for the most part, yeah, your seat is guaranteed, but not necessarily space for your bag in the overhead compartment. That is what ends up making me nervous, because I'm like, oh, all these people are already on the plane. Am I going to have a space to put this? Or in many cases, you get the chance to like go ahead and check your carry-on. And sometimes I do that just to avoid that particular headache. So
yeah. Anyway. And if you've ever had a checked bag lost, then that probably makes you a lot more hesitant to just like hand over your bag at the gate. It's not fun.
But I don't know. I think I've been fortunate. I don't think I've had a bag ever lost like that. But I still, I guess it's some of these unknowns, right, that ultimately make one nervous. Like, okay, there's going to be a line. How's it going to work? What section am I in? And then is there going to be room for my bag? Do I need to pre-check the bag now? I'm just kind of all over the place mentally at that point.
I wondered if you were going to do an Australian accent for the Australian elementary schoolers saying, can I have baggage? Apologize for that.
I don't think my Australian accent was ever very good. It kind of falters and becomes a bad Irish accent later on.
All right, this next message comes from somebody who just identified themselves as the letter A. So that is just fine. A says, "Dear Robert and Joe, so many things to write about Q theory. I consider myself a good-natured pedant with an appreciation for the categorical imperative. For decades, I have gleefully and cautiously zoomed past dutiful fellow Midwesterners who start lining up single file at the first notice of a lane closure. My conscience is clear as I mentally broadcast. Actually, it is better for everybody to use all the available lane capacity. Upon merging at a late enough entry point to get a little bit of a thrill, I will gladly let somebody else in front of me. And at times, when I'm caught waiting through the long backup, I'll still happily let in someone who is on their game and gets in at the last minute, saluting them for their good use of the road. I related something like this to my boss on the way to a job site, and he said that people who wait until the last minute to merge should be taken out of their cars and publicly executed. Fortunately, he's hard of hearing, so he just assumed I was complaining about those who use all of the road that the public is given. He's quite reasonable, and normally we would be up for a loud discussion about a traffic study, but I let the matter rest." This reminds me of the thing about, I think the conclusion I came to about the late merging thing is that obviously, yes, it is clearly logical that everybody should use all the lanes and do the late merging thing. But the problem is not everybody knows this. And until it is widely known and everybody gets it, you still maybe like have disincentives from doing it just because like people freak out.
Yeah. Or it's just not the cultural norm. It's kind of like, it's like eating bananas. So yeah. If you were hanging out with some people, or you're just in an environment where, hey, everybody has a banana now, everybody gets to eat a banana, are you going to open your banana the human way, or are you going to open it the way that I believe primates have been observed to open it, other non-human primates, from the bottom of the banana, which I've heard the argument, and I don't know if this is actually the case, but I've heard the argument being made that this is the better way to open the banana.
Yeah.
But if everyone else is doing it the other way, you're going to feel social pressure to follow their suit, right?
Well, yeah, but also, I mean, there is more of an illusion of a competition for resources in the traffic situation, whereas few people would want to shoot you in the face for the way you open a banana. People actually would say they want to do that about traffic, but of course, please, nobody, never engage in violence over, even if somebody is actually genuinely very rude in traffic. Come on, it's not worth it.
Yeah, and let people eat bananas how they want to eat bananas. Don't be a jerk about that either. Just going to put that out there.
So, A goes on. "I believe Q theory has some interesting applications in other dynamic road settings. When I'm on foot and need to cross a street, I would much rather a multi-ton vehicle keep its momentum rather than stop for me to cross and have to accelerate again." That is really admirable global energy conservation thinking. My hat is off to you. Goes on, "particularly when there are no other cars and everyone would be on their way more quickly if I only had to wait for them to cruise past my crossing point rather than waiting for them to come to a full stop before I cross in front of their deadly vehicle. I would consider this to be a good example of a Pareto improvement. I will typically conceal my intention to cross in order to facilitate this. Also, I'd much rather wait for a slug of traffic to clear the road than to make multiple cars stop just for me and mess up the flow. Where I live, people seem to fall all over themselves to stop their car for pedestrians waiting to cross. I believe this is the law, and there are obvious situations where it is the right thing to do, but it's clear that the system is flawed."
Oh, I've certainly been in situations where, you know, clearly the pedestrian has the right of way and there is a crosswalk, but traffic is terrifying. And therefore, I might wait for there to be like a slight clearance. Like, I'm not going to be the one to, like, I mean, my right of way only goes so far if a car actually hits me. And then sometimes I'll wait and for another person to want to cross as well and realize that there's strength in numbers. You know, surely they won't run over two or three of us.
Or do you ever wait for a cyclist who, at least in my experience, for some reason, just seem to be more fearless? Maybe the fact that people on bicycles are just so constantly threatened and menaced by people in cars that, like, they become immune to it?
I always try and be very careful around bicyclists. You know, they say share the road, but I feel like yield the road is a little more accurate.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it. I would much rather do that.
I mean, it's difficult because a lot of roads in modern cities and places are just not designed with cyclists in mind. I mean, it's great if there are like bike lanes or protected bike lanes or whatever. A lot of roads just like this was not built to accommodate bicycles.
Yeah. And I mean, I have friends who've been in some rough scrape ups between their bicycles and other cars. So, I mean, always be careful around bicyclists.
A goes on. While I was visiting South Korea a while back, it was the norm for drivers to blow through red lights when no other vehicles were in sight. Quite rightly, in my opinion, it makes sense to reject the one vehicle cue. Also, they definitely didn't treat pedestrians waiting to cross with the same indulgence they get over here. I'm no expert, but it seems like widespread modern traffic is maybe more recent in even a developed country like South Korea, and that perhaps a country's general approach to traffic queuing situations will change as more generations go by widespread automobile use. I believe this was the case in the US as cars became more common, although that is obviously a bit different. Why do we wait at red lights at 3 a.m. when no one else is on the road? When did we start doing this? Is this from our culture, or because vehicular travel has reached a level of maturity or more abundity in our society? It seems counter to the American ideal of individualism. I mean, I guess in my perspective on that, it would depend on, you would want to be really sure that you were actually able to see clearly in every direction and make sure that you weren't mistaken about the fact that somebody wasn't coming. Though I guess that's also true of just a stop sign.
Yeah, or turn signals, you know, I mean, that's always a situation where the turn signal lets people know what you're going to do, including people that you might not see, someone who might be in your blind spot, etc.
Finally, a truly egregious cue violation is when a car intending to travel straight through an intersection stops in order to yield to a vehicle queued up to turn left, waving them through the intersection and into the path of other cars that are still following the natural queuing order and may not be able to react to this apostasy. This mock politeness is nothing more than a thoughtless, self-serving grab for warm feelings and can be deadly. However, I do not believe it warrants public execution. Love the show, A.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I encounter a version of that a lot where I'm in a turn lane or I'm trying to make a turn across traffic and I have to go across two lanes of oncoming traffic.
Oh,
and
no.
A person in one lane will suddenly stop and try and wave me on.
But you can't see. Yeah,
I can't see the other lane. They probably have an entirely different view of this whole scenario. And I'm not going to, you know, venture into this this danger. But it puts you in a tough spot because one person is trying to be polite. They're just, you know, they don't have the virtues of your perspective on the situation, which you realize that there's danger in following their advice.
I think the correct solution to this is that all settled areas of human habitation should be fully grid mapped in terms of road access, and left turns should all be illegal. So everywhere you go full right turns and nothing but.
Yeah. Maybe so.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we have another bit of listener mail about sentient weapons here. Shall I read this one?
Go for it.
All right, this is from Cameron. Hello, Robert and Joe. I just listened to your episode, Whispers of the Speaking Sword. I wanted to point out a couple of examples of such weapons I am familiar with. The first, perhaps unsurprisingly, considering the mythological origins, comes from J.R.R. Tolkien. Tolkien encountered the Kalevala before his earliest Middle Earth writings were begun, and some aspects of some of the stories would become the Silmarillion can be traced back to it. In particular, Tolkien's tragic character Turin Turambar from the chapter of Turin Turambar in the Silmarillion, and also from the longer version of the same tale as published more recently, The Children of Hurin. Anyway, they continue. This was inspired by Kullervo and even has a talking sword of its own. Turin's sword, named Gurthong, appears to speak to Turin just before Turin uses it to commit suicide after discovering the truth about his accidentally incestuous marriage to his sister. This is, of course, right out of the Kalevala here. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they continue. In earlier versions of the Silmarillion, this same sword is prophesied to be used during the final battle, Dagor Degoroth, to defeat the first Dark Lord, Morgoth, when he returns from the Void. Additionally, sentient, or at least intelligent, weapons also appear in Xin Sha. This is, I believe, literally immortal hero, the genre of Chinese fantasy literature, where they are often referred to in English translation as spiritual weapons. These weapons often appear to have some sense of preferences or intentions, a strong spiritual connection to their users or makers, and sometimes the ability to act with some degree of autonomy. I am personally very new to this genre, but a recent example has gained popularity in the U.S. in the live-action drama The Untamed, which includes a few examples of spiritual weapons being used by its main characters. Thanks for another enjoyable episode, Cameron.
You know, in my current D&D campaign, one of the members of our party is a cleric, and he's got a really good spiritual weapon. It's a big old ghost hammer.
Oh yeah, spiritual weapon. That's a good cleric spell.
And every time he uses it, I end up singing that Snoop Dogg song.
Spiritual weapon?
I think the radio edit is called Sensual Seduction. But I sing Spiritual Weapon.
Okay. And I have to say, I'm not familiar with this Untamed TV series. It appears to be a 2019 Chinese television series adapted from a novel. So it looks interesting. But I'm assuming this is one that is available internationally on one service or another. So if you're interested in that, look it up. All right, Joe, do we have any Weird House Cinema listener mail to round things out with?
Oh, yeah, we got a bunch. I guess we've only got time for a couple right here, but I'll read this first one from Stacy, since it's about Deep Blue Sea. Stacy says, "Hello again, gentlemen. I have indeed seen Deep Blue Sea at the movies when it was new. I loved it then and still do. The biggest thing being talked about in my circles at the time was how this movie mercilessly killed off almost its whole cast. Whole families were saved in Jurassic Park, not so with the Smart Sharks. Also, I always thought Michael Rapaport's character was more of a facility engineer type." I think she's answering the fact that I said he was a scientist, so apologies about mm-hmm. that. But she says he knew about the emergency hatch ladder. That's a good memory, Stacy. Best regards, Stacy. And regarding your comparison to Jurassic Park, which is relatively very woolly compared to the way this movie treats its characters, I wonder if this is what the Jurassic Park franchise was trying to fix by filling Jurassic World with absolutely tonally inappropriate deaths by torture of characters who had done nothing wrong.
Yeah, there's that whole sequence with the lady getting scooped up by the pteranodon, yeah. And then or
like screaming, or
and then she's dropped into the tank with the it's rough.
I can't remember if I've ranted on this show before about how much I hate Jurassic World. I found that movie just repellent.
I remember disliking the tone at the time that I first saw it. But then I watched it again with the boy, with my son, and he seemed all right with it. So I'm kind of like, okay, maybe I'm overreacting. And then we watched that more recent one, which I don't know if I've mentioned this on the show before, but I found it interesting that it's essentially a Hannibal Lecter movie with dinosaurs.
Wait, the Haunted House one with dinosaurs?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I liked that one more. Yeah, that one was just absolutely, that was gooberlicious. It was, I don't know how else to put it. It was a Haunted House movie, but with raptors instead of ghosts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can definitely see the Haunted House comparisons. I do think it does have some. It's kind of like if Thomas Harris wrote a dinosaur movie as well. Yeah. There are some areas of it that I think line up with Hannibal Lecter fiction. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was pretty fun. All right, I'm going to read one here from Dan. Dan says, "Hello, Mr. Rob and Mr. Joe. I love Brad Dourif, and I'm so glad you finally discussed one of his movies. Wise Blood next? I've never seen Spontaneous Combustion, though it sounds like something I might have watched on the Sci-Fi Channel or TNT in the mid to late 90s, possibly with Joe Bob Briggs' intro. Highly possible." They continue. "Two movies that show Dourif's range as an actor that you did not mention or talk much about that I'd like to recommend are Alan Parker's Mississippi Burning and Werner Herzog's The Wild Blue Yonder. The former being about the FBI investigation into the murders of three civil rights workers in Mississippi, in which Dourif plays a sheriff's deputy and KKK member involved in the killings, while the latter is pure uncut Dourif crazed intensity in which he plays the alien," that's all caps, or at least capitalized, "who spends much of this documentary, quote-unquote, ranting to the camera about how he came from another galaxy and how we Earthlings think aliens are so powerful, but in truth, just suck." It's been a long time since I saw Mississippi Burning. I think I was like in junior high or so when I saw it. So I don't remember much of Dourif's performance. I definitely remember, who else in that? Gene Hackman.
I've never seen it. Obviously dealing with the much more serious subject matter than anything we usually do in Weird House Cinema.
Yeah, yeah, I don't think it's one we'll come back to, but I remember it as being a good film. It has what's his name? Green Goblin.
Willem Dafoe.
Yeah, Willem Dafoe is in it. He's good, and I think it has some other actors of note. Mm-hmm. And I haven't seen The Wild Blue Yonder. This is another one I'm familiar with. I definitely know it's one of the Herzog Dourif joints, but it's not one that I've seen. Anyway, Dan continues, speaking of aliens, what is it about Alien Resurrection that Joe hates so much? I haven't seen it in a long time, but I don't remember it being that terrible. Was it that they brought Ripley back as a clone with xenomorph DNA? On another note, I just want to say that I enjoy how Robert calls movies, films, motion pictures, or just picture. I think it brings a lot of classiness to the show. Hope you're doing well. Love the show. Dan.
I think for some reason you were saying motion picture a lot in the episode on spontaneous combustion. It was just in the air that day.
I don't know. I mean, a lot of it's probably elegant variation on my part, but but no, maybe I was trying to class it up a little bit too.
About Alien Resurrection, it's not any particular broad plot decisions. I mean, I think most broad plot decisions I could be okay with if, you know, if they're executed well. It's just something I just find the movie aesthetically nauseating, just like every single frame of it and the way it looks, the way it sounds is just disgusting to me.
I have to say, I don't know much about like the making of story on that one, but it clearly has, it has so many talented people involved in it. Yeah. The whole cast, we mentioned briefly, I think in the last one, how many great names are involved in that one. Bit players and the main characters. And of course the director is Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who did such films as Amelie and Delicatessen, a very
City
long
of Lost
engagement.
Children. Is that right?
Yes. He did City of Lost Children as well. Yeah. These are all films that really pop visually and I really like, Resurrection is not a film that I'm tremendously opposed to, but it's also not a film I've really watched a lot. And I would be curious as to what its production history is, because I know when you're dealing with an alien film, you're dealing with a huge corporate product. Yeah. And of course, yeah, there are stories, especially like Alien 3, about how susceptible that product is to like producer tinkering and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I guess just being a huge fan of the first two Alien movies, I have a lot of strong feelings about it too. So, though I actually really appreciate a lot of things about Alien 3. I mean, Alien 3 is a hard movie, to judge in terms of quality, because I think I've said this on the show before, but I sort of have to regard it as an unfinished film. Mm-hmm. It is a movie that has a lot of good stuff on the screen, a lot of good creative energy behind it. Some really great actors in it. Of course, Sigourney Weaver's wonderful as always, Charles S. Dutton, that's all great stuff. And I really like some of the production design on it. And basically the premise of the movie is interesting and very gutsy in a way. But also, I mean, having read about the production, I can understand why Fincher tried to disown it. The director, David Fincher, I think just because like it's a movie that he was not allowed to complete in a way that was creatively acceptable to him. And so in a way, what we have is just sort of like an unfinished film held together by duct tape and staples. Mm. Resurrection, I find absolutely revolting, and it literally hurts the viewer. as once you get back into the modern era, I haven't seen Prometheus again since I saw it in the theater, and I wonder what I would think of it now. I mean, my memory of it is that it was very beautiful to look at and had some really good sequences, but overall did not make a lot of sense and kind of irritated me. And then once you get into, what was the one after that one called that we did?
Alien Covenant.
Alien Covenant. Once you get into that area, it's like so stupid that it can just be pure fun again. So that's one of those movies. I think I've said this about a few movies recently. It's one where almost everything I can think of to say about it is a criticism, and yet I really enjoyed it. I love how in the middle of the movie, you have no choice. Like your eyes just turn into ping pong balls. It turns into this Island of Dr. Moreau movie with Michael Fassbender in the Moreau role. I don't know. It's so weird and so dumb and makes so little sense, but it is a lot of fun.
Yeah, I think Alien Covenant is essentially, there are three films in there, and I love two of them. What about the AVP films, Joe? You just skip right over them. You can't talk about dumb alien films without touching in on those, right?
Oh, yeah. That's a different kind of dumb. I haven't watched those in a while. I think I remember the first one being bad, but, an enjoyable kind of schlocky movie that I would definitely watch a couple times in college. There was one that came after that was like set in an American city. It was more like trying to do the thing that the more recent Predator movie was also doing, just like unleashing these on suburbia or whatever. And I remember thinking that one was really gross and unpleasant.
Yeah. I think what the world needed, I don't know if this is still a viable option, but I'm thinking underworld versus alien versus predator. That's what the world needs. You get your alien. I mean, you get your aliens in there, your xenomorphs. You have your predators in there. You also have werewolves and vampires.
How about Chucky and Leprechaun also? Because you got to have Brad Dourif.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Why not? Why not? I'll allow it.
Alien versus Chucky. There you go.
Alien's not going to know what to do. This is just a stuffed toy, right?
Right.
Or, Leprechaun, what's he going to do? Is he going to grant a wish to a xenomorph?
He's going to be totally out of his league. That would be good. But what does the xenomorph dream about? I wish for meat.
Yeah.
Okay, we've gone too long.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it up here. But we thank everybody who wrote in, shared messages with us. Keep them coming. We don't have time to respond to all of them. We don't have time to read them all on the show. But we do read them when they come in, at least to ourselves internally in our own brains. If you have thoughts on recent episodes, past episodes, you have thoughts on possible future episodes, or if you have episodes on possible future thoughts, just let us know. You know how to get in touch with us. And you can find listener mail every Monday in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind feed, core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Artifact on Wednesday, Weird House Cinema on Friday. That's our time to just set most of the science aside and discuss a weird film, and on the weekends we have a rerun for you.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon. Just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
There's a lot of pros to drinking Health Aid kombucha. No cons that I can think of. Pro, amazing taste. Pro, pairs well with anything. Pro, probiotic. That's a literal pro. And it's deliciously refreshing. It's the perfect pairing to your meal or great on its own, whether you're having Pink Lady Apple, Berry Lemonade, or one of the other great flavors. It's the perfect swap for soda or alcohol. Make it part of your daily routine. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid Kombucha today.